Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I am joined by my father, Scott Keith, and our friend, John Hoyam. How you doing, John?
Doing pretty well. Good to be here with you guys.
You know, I think people are starting to recognize you on the show. You've been on, this is probably episode six or seven episodes you've been on now.
Yeah, I don't know what you're thinking.
No clue.
And, we don't either.
You know, the first two...
Coronavirus, we're scraping the bottom of the barrel. Just kidding.
Oof.
That was a joke,
people. So, yes, we had some coronavirus, you know, recording, which made it easier to do... We were forced into the call-in situation. I think Thinking Fellows listeners who have been listening to a long time know that we've never done a call-in episode before, and coronavirus hit, and then we started doing some call-in episodes, and so we were able to get you because you're up in the Seattle area, and... For people who aren't familiar, you're a junior.
Do you live anywhere near this new police-free zone in Seattle?
Near the Chaz?
The Chaz, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like maybe a mile and a half from the Chaz.
Oh, wow.
But the Chaz is not all it's cracked up to be. It's basically the Capitol Hill block party without any cool bands.
Oh, okay. Okay. I heard immediately some dude moved in and declared himself like the mayor slash chief of police.
Although, yeah, I think he just did that to promote his new mixtape.
Oh, okay.
Did he have a weapon?
Yeah. He'd walk around with an AK-47.
Wow. Brave. So, well, besides that, so you're in the Seattle area, generally speaking. So you came in on two coronavirus episodes. And then you're a member, and I am too, of what's called the Junior Fellowship at 1517, which we have senior fellows, senior distinguished fellows, and... full fellows, and then we have junior fellows who are waiting one day to maybe become full fellows of the think tank at 1517. And you know, I had an idea.
I like to call you research assistants.
Research assistants. Yeah. I had an idea a couple weeks back to, you know, maybe start a video podcast with the members of the Junior Fellowship to use as a platform to discuss research topics of interest. Keeping up with reading, that kind of thing. And so we piloted that by doing two Thinking Fellows episodes, just the last two, actually. And now now that the restrictions have opened up quite a bit, you decided to come vacation down in Southern California. And so you're just staying here.
Bit
so
of beautiful Big Bear Lake, California.
Yeah, yeah. With all this vacation I've got saved up for the year, I needed to use some. So I decided to come down and hang out for a few days. So yeah. It's
guys,
good to be here.
You guys going to go fishing or anything?
We should go fishing. I don't know. Do you fish?
I haven't fished for years, but I'm kind of open to whatever.
Yeah.
You just show me how you live around here, and we'll do it.
We'll go hit that secret trout spot.
Secret trout spot. Have you ever gotten any trout there?
One.
Okay.
one. Count them one.
So, I'll look forward to trout dinner tomorrow night.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens. So we were going to talk about today's episode, The Theologian's Craft. Now, this is... in part, an essay by Montgomery that's titled the same, called The Theologian's Craft, but it's also an interesting question about what is the task of the theologian and how do they execute it. And on the Thinking Fellows, I think we try to do this, and we try to engage our audience as people potentially also engaging this craft, right? So we had, for a long time on the Thinking Fellows, done episodes where we emphasized not using our podcast as your source of authority for a particular issue, but using it as a jumping off point to expand your knowledge. So if you listen to an episode on justification by us, it's not supposed to be the end all be all. We also tell you to go, you know, read the things we've said we've read, like our confessions on the issue, or maybe Melanchthon's Loci on the issue, or other Reformation texts, or maybe even texts we disagree with. Go read Calvin's Institutes and see if there's any differences that you spot between the Lutheran Reformers and Calvin on this. Maybe read a modern theologian and see what it's like and compare it against, you know, what you've read and what you've read against Scripture. And so I think we should revisit that topic a little bit in light of this today. And you had this idea, Dad, of maybe...
Yeah, I mean, it's fun hanging out with you guys because I hear you talk and it reminds me of talking with my friends when I was younger and very excited about learning theology and sort of knowing as much as I could about the topic. And it got me thinking that, you know, there really is, we've dropped this word altogether and or given it over just to the trades, which are somewhat non-existent these days. But this idea of what we do is a craft. It's not just the study of theology. It's not just memorizing certain facts and historical dates and theological formulas out of a book of systematic theology. It's to be good at it. It's a craft. It's something that you work at. And there's there's various ways of, like anything, learning any craft. There's various ways of sort of approaching developing the craft. I remember we used to have a professor at CUI named Bob Dargitz. Everybody loved Professor Dargitz. He wasn't always the guy that you went to like with your hardest questions, but he was just a wonderful man, a great pastor.
Yeah, we went to his church a couple times.
Yeah, in Emmanuel Lutheran in Orange.
Gorgeous sanctuary if you are in Southern California. It's worth the visit to just see sort of like an attempt at an older, like Midwestern-looking Lutheran church in Southern California.
Yeah, and I remember one day before class, my friend Jeff Mallinson, myself, and another friend of ours, Josh Rosenthal, were outside of class arguing about something. And we were always arguing because at that time, Dr. Mallinson was a pretty staunch Calvinist, and Josh and I were not. The interesting thing to that is that now Dr. Mallinson is a Lutheran, and I'm not sure what Josh is. I haven't talked to him in many, many years. But he did go over to Calvinism when doing a PhD down at University of Arizona under Heiko Obermann. Crazy. But and Professor Dargitz walks up and he's like, "Oh, I love to see this. This is iron sharpening iron." And I had never really heard that before. I just thought we were arguing. Right? But as Professor Dargitz approached this and looked at it, we were actually learning our craft with each other. And it got me thinking, being around you guys and hearing, the passion with which you guys still address all these issues, that it would be interesting doing an episode on your perspective on how one sort of becomes a theologian and what it takes. And of course, I referenced you to Dr. Montgomery's essay, The Theologian's Craft, which is very good. It's a good start. I've often recommended that for research methodologies courses as one of the starts. He's also got a little booklet on the writing of research papers, which is also very good. It should be checked out. But anyway, I thought it'd be fun to do an episode on what does it take to become a theologian? What does it take to develop the craft of doing theology? I mean, if you were learning to be welders, there'd be a certification program, right? And you'd know that after you did this class and this class and this class and sort of took this skills competency test and that one, you could now be certified to weld steel or aluminum as either TIG or MIG or whatever. But it's not so simple in theology. You you can go get the degrees, but if you get the degrees, are you a theologian because you have the degrees? Can you be a theologian without having the degrees? These are all deep thoughts.
Interesting. I kind of think, well, so when the question of what makes you a theologian makes me think of the Heidelberg Disputation,
because I'm always naturally
thinking about the Heidelberg Disputation. But I mean, that's thesis 19 and 20 are, he is not worthy to be called a theologian, and he is worthy to be called a theologian, basically based upon that place where that person searches to access God, and one is either through naturally occurring events, which is the he is not worthy to be.
Right.
And the other is through the folly of God at the cross, which is where he is worthy to be. But that's not a very technical answer, right? That's not how you...
Well, that doesn't... That wouldn't encapsulate what the craft of doing theology is. I know Dr. Montgomery, he talks about sort of having a wide variety of inputs up to and including reading broadly and developing a broad theological library and that type of thing. And I wonder if even that's enough.
Yeah, I think it starts with, and it starts with a master above you. Like it starts with a student seeking out a mentor or being handed one. I think in my case, that started with you very young, right? The running joke is that you always told me to go do something like law.
Yeah,
like
go be a lawyer.
to use the
although I've heard there's a glut of lawyers.
So. Yeah,
you maybe not the guaranteed income I thought it was.
But you know, through you, there was a certain level of reading, expectation, critical thinking when it came to the faith generally and my catechesis in the home. Catechesis wasn't primarily, I would say, not at the church for me. I mean, I did go through confirmation and that, but there was a at-home catechesis, and as the interest in the theological questions kept going, you kept giving me more things to do, consider. If I would say something that I heard you say, and just say it firmly, and it just justifications by grace through faith, you go, well, how do you know that? Is it because I believe it? And you'd make me think
it's either
about
being
it.
A very good dad or being a very pain in the butt dad.
Yeah.
I don't know which one
it is. I mean,
it's
kind of an interesting thing, right? It's like the opposite of a lot of what I see, which is like, you know, forcing your kids to memorize certain dogmas, right? And chants. Whereas if I had memorized it and I thought the right thing to do would be to say it, you would push back on why I thought the right thing to do would be to.
That's interesting to me because that. I think one of the things we have going on these days is a lot of people who memorize just a lot of stuff. And I'm critical of that. I like that they're reading a lot, and I even like that they have good memories and can sort of catalog it all and bring it all up. And I think part of learning anything, up to and including theology, is the ability to sort of organically grab hold of information so much that you can regurgitate it. But I don't think the regurgitation's enough.
Yeah, all you know, learning
that's
starts
not,
with memorization.
Yeah, that's not synthesis or it's merely synthesis. That's not there's no sort of analytical aspect to that where you're actually okay, now I learned this, I memorized it. I've been told it's the right answer even. That happens with our guys a lot, I think. I've been told this is the right answer, but then if you ask, well, why is that the right answer? How do you know that's the right answer? How do you know that your source that told you it's the right answer is correct when they say it's the right answer?
Yeah, and even, as you said, the synthesis, I wrote a blog, I think, 3 years ago now. It's wild.
You're going to bring that one up, eh?
They blend. Where I talked about this, where, you know, like Lutherans, if you grow up in a Lutheran church, you're going to, more likely than not, memorize a small catechism at least once. Now, the question is there a point at which you have synthesized the information, you can communicate the contents of the small catechism, that if 10 years down the line you can't cite it word for word, but you can articulate
but you still know
the
it.
Doctrine therein, and you still know it and believe it in your heart, is that more valuable than having it memorized line for line? And in this blog, I argued that there was a value to that, that there's a moving past memorization, that person might even understand the catechism more than the person who just has the child who just has every line memorized.
Yeah.
Or maybe not. I mean, at some level you might lose all of it, but I think the question.
Well, there's a difference between, you know, memorizing and knowing and understanding. Those are all, you know, those are all certain different things. You can memorize words on a page and it doesn't mean that you believe those words or taken them to heart. You can even spit them back out and it doesn't mean that. And I think in terms of what is the theologian's craft and what does it mean to do theology, I think part of that is to be able to interact with the information that you've learned/memorized in a critical way. And by critical, I mean, you know, you can question the assumptions. You're not afraid to question the assumptions of the things that you've learned. And I've always, especially recently, I wonder about what our worry is when people sort of read outside the box or people sort of ask questions that aren't perceived as orthodox or, you know, engage in information with information that seems questionable. If we believe this thing that we teach, that we say we believe, teach, and confess, if we believe it to be true, that means that we believe it to have the ability to withstand the scrutiny, right?
Yeah, I might come at this from a sort of different direction from you guys. And the reason for this is my background, having grown up in the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. And as listeners might know, the ELCA was known for this sort of long slide into sort of liberal Protestant theology. And, you know, so I think, you know, of course, you guys are Missouri Synod LCMS. But over in the ELCA, I think over the years, the sort of church context that I was in had lost the importance of major texts,
right.
texts that you memorize.
Even the catechism.
Even the catechism, yeah. memorizing Bible verses. And so I think that, you know, in kind of a more liberal Protestant kind of context, there is more of an emphasis on, well, you could almost call it a reader response criticism, a reader response to everything, which is the way that you read texts is you see how they make you feel.
Yeah.
And then the truth is found in your experience
yeah.
of them. And so I think that for me, you know, I think that there is great value in memorization, and there's also great value in having a canon of texts that you study over and over again. And this doesn't mean that you don't critically engage them, but, you know, I agree with what you guys are saying, but I think that there is a danger in being so open that you actually lose having commitments altogether. Does that make sense?
I agree with that completely, and I don't want it to be understood that I even think Caleb are advocating for
not memorizing.
I think memorization is very important, but it's the first step, is I guess I would say. If we're talking about what makes a theologian, I wouldn't say what makes a theologian is just the ability to memorize certain texts. That, you know, if you were to, I mean, pedagogically, if you were to put this sort of into steps, that'd be step number one. That wouldn't be step number three or four, right? And that's all I'm saying here. But I think that, you know, what you saw in the ELCA is almost the antithesis of what I'm arguing for here, because reader response focuses on how, you know, a certain text makes you feel. Mm-hmm. And like you said, in the feeling, then that feeling becomes the truth of the text.
It's your experience that becomes the measure. Yeah.
I'm actually advocating for, you know, discerning whether said text is true or not.
Right.
You know,
right.
And is there anything out of it that can be found to be valuable, or is it all hogwash? Does it all need to be thrown out, baby and bathwater? Or does some of it need to be kept? And how will we know if we don't engage these texts? I mean, the thing that I'm fighting against here, I guess, is just the sense that I have that, especially in portions of my church, or the academic community, I guess I'd say, in my church, that we operate with a certain amount of fear, that we can't engage this text or that text. And I just don't think that makes you, well, one, I don't think it makes you a good scholar
mm-hmm.
In any field. And two, I don't think it makes you a good theologian.
Or engage it with the presupposition that it's going to be wrong, I think is the other aspect of it. So if you have a particular person's name or from a particular theological school, we can assume that my job in reading this text is to find out how and where it's wrong. And mm-hmm. not just with other Lutheran texts, but you can do this with like people just in other traditions, right? You could, Karl Barth would be a great example. I'm going to go read that to go find out why he's wrong.
Yeah. And I'd say we're all guilty of that a little bit. I know I am. And I think that's why one of the first steps in becoming a theologian is to at least, and we've said this on multiple episodes recently, maybe it was on the YouTube videos I'm doing. I don't remember.
Probably.
Just be aware of your presuppositions as you come into something. In a lot of ways, you're just talking about what's the scholar's craft too,
yeah.
you know?
But I think that there's two extremes here, right? So one is to treat a very small number of authorized texts as the only ones that you will read and study in any detail, and then you just regurgitate the truth
right.
found therein. And then I think on the other side, we also want to caution against a sort of academic approach that makes originality the be all and end all of being a scholar.
Yeah.
So
or scattershotness, I guess I would say. You know, just, you know, walk into a library, pick a book off the shelf and try to pigeonhole it into mm-hmm. becoming, that's not what I'm advocating for either. But a well thought out approach to reading broadly, to studying broadly, to engaging with multiple ideas and or systems of information and being able to comprehend them. One of the biggest criticisms I even hear it of myself, although I'd argue that it's not that true with me. but that, you know, if you're going to speak of another position, be sure you can represent that position well.
Yep.
You know, i.e. Calvinism or something yeah. like that, or, you know, Rome or whatever, in our case, looking at other positions. But how can you do that if you don't read them?
Right. And like in the case of Lutherans, it can be kind of easy to say, represent medieval scholastic Roman thought and not address anything that's changed in the language or the way those positions have been argued in the last 500 years. Just go, Rome believes X, and refer back to
what your professor told you they believe.
Back from your Ren and F class.
Yeah.
I think one of the first things that happens when you engage with a wide variety of texts is before you move to making a criticism, so say, I mean, you have a Lutheran who's reading Reformed theology, before rejecting what is said or written because it's wrong, you have to first be able to make distinctions. And I think that that's one of the most important things about engaging texts critically is what is the position and how is it distinct from its alternatives? And you actually have to make that move before you move on to saying, well, it's wrong.
Right. And I think also just to take it back to like a basic class, you need to be aware of sort of your formal and material principle and the formal, especially if you're just getting into it, the formal principle with which they're using or that they're using to base their text and then try to discover their material principle. So for the listeners who don't remember, formal principle is just sort of the source upon which you're basing your idea, right? Or your material principle. Your material principle is the main thing, right? It's the main idea of any sort of group of ideas and or system. So in our case, we would say the material principle is salvation by grace alone, through faith alone, on account of Christ alone. And our formal principle, how do we know this? Well, this is all information that we derive from Scripture alone. Now, a lot of systems in Christianity say Scripture alone too, and so that's sort of also got to be fleshed out a little bit. But that's part, honestly, I think that's one of the big, if I were to step back, I'd say that's one of the biggest parts of the theologian's craft is just in reading somebody to try to determine
those things are.
Or what are they basing, especially their formal, what are they basing this on? As they argue, make this argument, what's the foundation of the argument?
And listen or read for what they claim it is as well.
Right.
Instead of just assuming or saying, you hear this one all the time. They're Catholics, so their form of principle is the Pope. Right. Okay. Well, that's real basic. Like maybe in a particular systematic theology, that's not where they're claiming to derive the information that they're.
Well, yeah, and it can, and the reality is, say, in terms of Roman Catholicism, it can be multiple things or multiple people, you know, decrees of councils, scripture, of course.
Centuries of tradition,
papal fiat is certainly one of them, but it's not the only one.
Nope.
And so that changes the game a little bit. If you're coming into a discussion with a Roman Catholic as a Lutheran, and you think that they're dealing with the same principle of scripture alone as you are, you guys will talk past each other all day long because they actually can draw on sort of a wider berth of authorities upon which to base an argument.
Mm-hmm. I think that's good.
But you have to know that to have that conversation. And if you don't, and I'd argue this is part of the theologian's craft. If you don't know that, you can't have a really good discussion. It's like the first step in a debate is to define your terms, right? You have to define these terms. You have to be able to know your sources of authority well enough to recognize those that the other person's dealing with.
I think that gets back to what I was saying at the beginning, which is finding sort of a mentor, being given a mentor or a master in the discipline who can help guide some of that. I'm not saying it's impossible to self-read yourself into some theological knowledge into doing theology, but I think it's hard without the handing down of some of these insider secrets from somebody else who can help push you and also listens to the conversations or reads your writing and knows which ways you lean, which ways you need to be challenged, and things like that. I actually think of something John Milbank said about graduate study in the UK, where basically it's about, now it's about where can I get in, what can I afford,
used to
who's
going to
fund me.
With whom could I study?
And it used to be, with whom can I study? Yeah. And he said liberal education isn't going to return in a meaningful way until you can ask that question again and somebody learning theology can approach a mentor, a master of the craft, and say, can I study with you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Will you teach me?
Will you teach me, yeah.
Yeah,
I had a similar experience growing up to you, Caleb, my dad was a pastor, and the experience of being able to talk theology with him and talk about books and have him recommend books at various stages of my learning was hugely helpful. It's like an indispensable part of becoming a theologian is that that mentorship. And you'll have more than one mentor over the years. I mean, my dad has always been formative for my understanding of theology and my activity in the church, but in school I've had mentors as well. I honestly couldn't imagine trying to do theology alone just with books.
Yeah. I'm not sure it's possible. I mean, I think there's a lot of information that you can learn, but I think until you engage with people that will challenge you, and I guess I'd add this to the theologian's craft, is you have to be challenged. Until you engage with people that challenge you, it's incomplete. I think about this even now, like this YouTube series I'm doing on postmodernism with Bruce Hillman out in New York. You know, he and I don't agree on everything. He's a Lutheran. He's a card carrying, confession swearing Lutheran, to the core. And he and I just don't agree on some of this stuff. And the conversations, I told people that you should check it out because I thought it was just going to be Bruce and I explaining postmodernism, but it's basically
you and Bruce arguing.
It's basically like we're doing nine. It's kind of funny that we're doing nine episodes because it's going to be like nine rounds on postmodernism. And, but that makes me better, right? I know postmodernism better for having argued with Bruce about postmodernism. And that's good. You know, that's a good thing. I'm interested in this. I want to know more about it. I want to know more about why society is reacting as it is, why deconstructive elements of society are making such a headway currently. And I wouldn't know sort of the foundation of this as well as I'm getting to without arguing with Bruce a little bit.
Yeah,
I think that's a big part of it. So I think you have that person who helps push you and guide you. And then I would say, you know, as we were saying with the reading, in Montgomery's essay, he talks about this as developing your library. So how does a theologian develop their library? And you've said it on the show before, Dad, that he constantly just uses the phrase, read broadly. And if you dive into what that means, it means read people within the craft of theology that you disagree with, but also read texts that aren't theological, right? So read history, read philosophy, read some classical literature.
Think about all of the fields that philosophy intersect, and that's philosophy, geez, theology intersects with, especially now. I mean, history for sure, right? Philosophy for sure. Politics. One of the talks I'm giving a talk for Higher Things. It'll be on their online conference because all their conferences got canceled this year, but it's on church and state, which I was happy to get rather than someone else. But, you know, politics are in there, sociology, psychology. I mean, one of the things I love about the study of theology is because I have a hard time just focusing on one thing forever. But studying theology allows you to know a little bit about a lot of stuff, and then hopefully a lot about one field. And I could not recommend more, not just reading broadly, but studying broadly, listening broadly, having a willingness to, you know, go to lectures and to talks that are from people that, you know, aren't on the approved list as well as those that are. The fact that I think we have a podcast called Banned Books that, is a play on the fact that during the Counter-Reformation, the Roman Catholic authorities developed a list of actually banned books. And, a lot of those books were from Lutheran authors. Books, yeah. And so
our boys make the list quite a bit.
The fact that now we joke about having an approved list within Lutheranism is ironically hilarious. So. Read broadly, study broadly, listen broadly. I read some crazy stuff all over the place and engage with information from all over the spectrum. And I don't, you know, I'm not saying that everyone should do that, but you should do something akin to that in your area of interest. You know, have other interests. That's the other thing I would say, have other interests other than just theology. It'll round you out in your conversations with people. You can, you know, if you have some other interest, you can engage in theological conversations with people that aren't theologically minded because you can relate to their interests too.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever been to a theological conference, sorry for the people that this might hurt a little bit, but there's like a difference between the person who, like, when you go hang out at the bar afterwards, you can just hang out with because they do more than just theology, right? Like they can talk about their hobbies, their family, the stuff they go do.
Well, it's like hanging out with my buddy Paul and I, who's been on the show quite a bit, talk about this kind of thing all the time, is that, you know, he's a pastor, but he's not your typical sort of pastor. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way, although I'm sure it sounds that way, but he's just a guy. You know, I remember when we were in college together and he was studying to be a DCE and he was thinking about going to seminary, and he came and talked to me and said, "Do you think I should go to seminary?" And I said, "Yeah, because we need more pastors that are just good men, just good normal guys." And he's a great pastor too, and studies his butt off to be that, you know, reads broadly, took that advice from Montgomery.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good one. The way this intersects with the Thinking Fellows, I think, a bit, is that we have lots of subscribers who listen to the show every week, or at least their phone automatically downloads it every week. We know, and in doing that, I think there can be the habit, and we talked about this really early on the show, of sort of making the Thinking Fellows your source of authority. So if we say X about a doctrine, X is true, right? I mean, one of the points of the show is to just open up the avenues of exploration, like to open up the avenue of doing theology to people, to make it comfortable. Part of why we drink on the show.
I was going to say, people got to realize what this show is. It's three guys who, and oftentimes women too, who have studied theology, usually for a living, sometimes as an avocation, who are sitting around a table, usually drinking bourbon or a beer. Sometimes when the stars are all aligned, smoking a pipe too, just talking about stuff that interests them.
And I would say
it's nothing more than that, guys.
And I would say that's when you know you've met somebody who's sort of become a theologian, is when it's just sort of like casual. They can talk to people about it. I think this is a problem with a lot of people with just in families, like where it's, you know, for families who even go to church together every Sunday, where it's awkward to talk about theology or God in the house, right? Outside of like saying your evening prayers, questions are hard. And you sort of know that once it's become comfortable, once it's just one of the topics that can be had around the dinner table, or one of the topics that can be had around at the bar, where you can sort of get into a groove and just shoot the, you know, words we can't say on podcasts about it. That I think that's kind of like that final mark is like, you're not making stuff up, and you also don't have to sit there with your books in front of you to be able to talk about it.
Yeah. And I'm going to add something to your, so it starts with being a mentor. It goes into reading broadly, engaging in conversations with people with whom you disagree. I'd say next to that is have friends. Like actual friends. I mean, the value of friendship in this endeavor is drastically underestimated. I'm not sure, you know, I don't care if you and your friends agree on almost everything, or you disagree on, you know, some major things or what, but have some friends that you are able to do this with. Because if you don't have somebody to do this with, if it's always just mentor to mentee, you know, you're sort of, there's a loneliness that'll creep in with it that is, you know, it's going to sound dramatic, but it's painful.
Yeah, you need a little camaraderie.
Yeah.
To be able to get through.
Yeah. I mean, you need more than me to talk to about this stuff, and more than your advisor to talk to about this stuff. You need somebody that's relatively at the same place you are to talk to about this stuff, and then to change conversations to talk about other stuff. I mean, it's heartening to hear you the other day on the phone with your friend Jacob, who's a seminary student, talking about road bikes, you know, and not about theology. It's great that you guys talk about theology too, but there's other stuff to life, man.
Oh, exactly.
There are trucks after all.
As we see rotating on your computer screen, the
back and of airplanes,
an old Chevy.
Yeah, I'll maybe make my confession of my interest that is actually outside of theology.
Oh, but I've been waiting for this. What is it?
So on my way here,
it'd be like calligraphy or something.
I couldn't resist making my way to Southern California by way of the North Coast. Mm-hmm. So for those who don't know, this is where the California redwoods, the coastal redwoods, grow, and I am absolutely obsessed with trees.
Oh,
so I have an amateur interest in botany, especially the botany of the Pacific Northwest.
Do you know the trees in this area?
I know a few of them, yeah.
I used to teach outdoor education up here. I can teach you all about the trees of the San Bernardino National Forest.
Well, I was hoping to get a hike in with you guys eventually, so we should talk about the flora here, maybe the fauna as well.
The Pacific Crest Trail, and you'll see about just everything there.
Oh, you can just see the little trail by my house, and you'll see.
That's right.
Yeah. Could go down to Dogwood and see the sequoias. There's actually giant sequoias down in Lake Arrowhead.
Really?
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have to go see them.
You should.
But I just on this topic of having another interest, I mean, sometimes, like in the evening, I get home and all I want to do is just go on Google Maps and do like geography.
Oh, you need to meet my friend Dave Ruffner. That's what he does.
Yeah, I've actually drawn maps.
Oh my God.
Off and on.
Ruffner's going to be so happy to hear there's another map nerd encapsulated within 1517.
But you need to be able to indulge those interests, especially if you have a type of work like theology or ministry that is quite demanding and requires you to escape from it.
Yeah. Just even escape from your own brain for a while.
Yes.
That's me.
I mean, you make fun of me for it, but that's why I like fishing. Like, when I go fishing alone in the mornings or with
fishing,
like,
is
one
so
person,
damn boring.
No, you just, there's nobody out there. There's no talking. It's just you, like, casting.
I can't believe you like the no talking part. Just, that's so shocking to
you
me.
You just stare over the water, and it's just quiet. Yeah. Like, you don't have to.
You don't start talking to yourself? I bet you do. Me? Have you ever listened? Do you start talking to yourself?
Probably a little bit about like tying the knot, like stupid trout or something like that. But why won't you bite the bait? That kind of thing.
Mm.
Well, guys, I think this is a good first episode. I mean, the alcohol's warming up, so we gotta.
So episode 2 will be better, of course.
So episode 2 will be better. But hey, thank you for listening to this episode of Thinking Fellows.
Check out Montgomery's Theologian's Craft.
Yeah, well, I'll find the book. It's in a collection of essays. It's not just like on.
I'm sure we've got the PDF somewhere.
So we'll get that available in the show notes. The other portion of this that I wanted to do is I wanted to plug the newest podcast on the 1517 Podcast Network. If you've made it this far, you would certainly be interested in it. It's called the Outlaw God Podcast. It features Stephen Paulson, and it's he and I talking about basically his journey through theology and to writing this three-volume series he has out called Luther's Outlaw God, which is, you know, one part systematic theology, one part commentary on Luther's Bondage of the Will, one part, confessional Lutheranism.
Some part straight exegesis.
Yeah, it's a lot of biblical interpretation.
A lot of that. In fact, I've been surprised on the show how many times Paulson and I just end up doing whole episodes on like two verses in the Old Testament or something like that. So go ahead and you can subscribe to that. You can go to 1517.org/outlawgod to see it there. Or it's on your favorite podcasting apps. Just type in Outlaw God, and it's got a nice bright orange cover art. You can't miss it. All right, well, thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time. Bye.